From a modern perspective, rock and roll may seem like one of the most outdated genres in the musical landscape. The majority of audiences these days are listening to the pop, rap, or new indie that take up the majority of hit radio time. But it wasn't always this way. From its inception, rock and roll began as a reactionary youth culture. Before rock and roll went mainstream, it was the trash music that parents didn't want their kids listening to. It was vulgar, sexual, and not very Christian. Rock and roll was born out of rebellion. Let's talk about it. Good afternoon, Golden Hawks, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Laurier. My name is Megan, and you are listening to The Downbeat, the show where I get into the nitty-gritty, the deep cuts, and the hot topics of rock and roll throughout the decades. Despite being considered the dad genre of modern music, rock and roll was initially developed out of youth culture. Kids in the 1950s were tired of the teeny-bopping pop musings they were hearing on the radio and gravitated to the more exciting and controversial stylings of early rockers. Early rock and roll was controversial not only because of the sometimes suggestive subject matter, but also because of racist views of the time. You see, many white families didn't want their children listening to rock and roll because the very first rock and rollers were black.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ring in a bell.
After all, the genre itself was developed out of R&B for the most part, a genre that was partially alienated from mainstream pop because of its different sound on one hand, and on the other hand, simply because the artists performing the singles weren't white. Oftentimes, songs that would become hits on the pop charts were re-recordings of songs initially put out by black performers that were charted on the R&B charts. The white recordings did better because it was socially acceptable to enjoy the songs when they were cleaned up lyrically and sang by, well, white people. To many segregationists, rock and roll music was the perfect target for their racist propaganda. They posed it as a means to which the black man could brainwash pure white children with his vulgar and obscene ways. So, it's no surprise that with this discourse surrounding rock and roll, white parents wanted to make sure their children had nothing to do with it. And this, as often happens with teenagers, gave teens all the more reason to love it. To the majority of youth at the time, there was no segregation in terms of music. If they could dance to the tune, they did. To them, the purpose of rock and roll was to raise white people to the level of the black person, not bring them down, as many adults suggested. This racist background surrounding rock and roll may seem like the distant past, but even some of it stands today. Don't believe me? Just ask the majority of people who they consider to be the father or king of rock and roll. If they tell you Elvis Presley, they're ill-informed, because in actuality, the very first face of rock and roll and true king of the genre is none other than the first guitar hero himself, Chuck Berry.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished him well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell.
Chuck Berry is the first rock and roll rebel we are highlighting this week. Berry was an excellent craftsman when it came to songs particularly targeted at youth. After all, that is who the genre originally catered to, remember? The majority of his songs were story songs, where the lyrics walk the listener through a story throughout the song's duration. The content of these songs often targeted conservative institutions or praised teens for dancing to the forbidden music of rock and roll. For the most part, his songs used playful wordplay and upbeat tunes to target adult culture, which was firmly rooted in racism and other forms of discrimination. By pandering to teens, Berry managed to shift the youth culture's views in a more progressive direction. For this reason, he can easily be considered the first rebel of rock history. He broke into the mainstream, to the dismay of many white Southerners at the time, showing kids across America how to duck walk or give one hell of a guitar solo. Without Chuck Berry, there would be no rock and roll.
Up in the morning and out to school. The teacher is teaching the golden rule. American history and practical math.
Now, on to rock and roll's best-known original bad boy, Elvis Presley. Growing up in Mississippi, Elvis was surrounded by the country and blues-based early rock that was first rising into popularity thanks to Berry. After moving to Memphis in his youth, Elvis got full exposure to the R&B scene there and began recording at Sun Records in 1952. His 1953 hit, That's Alright Mama, which was originally recorded by blues singer Arthur Big Boy Crudup, catapulted him and Sun Records into the mainstream.
Well, that's alright, mama. That's alright for you. That's alright, mama. Just any way you do, that's alright.
Because of this breakthrough, many credit Elvis with introducing rock to the American masses, as he brought many rockabilly artists who are also signed with Sun along with him. But what about Elvis made him a rebel, aside from popularizing this rebellious form of music? Well, to many, the trajectory of modern culture was shifted off its axis when Elvis did something that no one in television history had ever done before. He shook his pelvis on national TV.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit and you ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said you was high class.
In 1956, Elvis appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show for a performance of his song Hound Dog, and conservatives across the country were dumbfounded. Although his dance moves may not seem all that provocative from today's standards, for the time, his leg shaking and pelvis wiggling were enough to prompt an anti-Elvis statement from the Roman Catholic Church itself. Television critics across America called the performance vulgar and animalistic. He caused such an uproar that the initial taping was censored, and from then on, Elvis's live TV performances were shot from the waist up. There is no doubt that when it comes to rock and rollers wreaking havoc on conservative mainstream values, Elvis was a pioneer.
Lord Almighty, I feel my temperature rising. Higher, higher, it's burning through to my soul.
Alright, so thus far, you could say that our definition of a true rock and roll rebel involves an unwavering desire to do as one pleases, no matter how much that might disrupt the status quo. Authentic rock and rollers don't seek to please, but rather to shake things up, to stir the pot. By this definition, it would be a crime to continue this episode without mentioning the freewheeling voice of a generation, Bob Dylan.
The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
To many people, specifically other notable rock artists, Bob Dylan is one of the, if not the most, influential rock figures in rock and roll history. Starting out playing in New York clubs after dropping out of college, Dylan considered himself a rambling poet. Quickly catching the attention of the masses, Dylan made his way to becoming a head figure of the folk movement throughout the 1960s. Now, before I continue rambling on about Bob Dylan for a few minutes, I want to first emphasize the importance of the folk movement itself in terms of breaking the status quo and rebelling against society, in a sense. The folk revival, in itself, had strong ties to political tensions of the time. Folk artists were regarded as one with the people and expressed the forward-thinking views of those who backed the civil rights movement, protested against Vietnam, and criticized American capitalism. I think that it's extremely important to note this significance, as of all of these people, all of these disruptors who denied the conservatism of the 50s and were passionate about the change to come in the 60s, Bob Dylan was elected the voice of truth. As a rambling poet, as he called himself, Dylan wrote songs of protest and change, and many people shared these views, particularly the youth at the time. Are we seeing a pattern here? It's most often the case that those rock and roll artists who are able to connect with the youth on a deeper level are those that are considered the most rebellious, as they are the ones that are the change makers. Those that can connect with the people who are able to make the change are thus change makers and voices for the masses. And Bob Dylan was the ultimate. What made Dylan different from Chuck Berry and Elvis, however, was that he took his connection with the youth a step further. Berry wrote songs to get kids thinking about opposing their parents, to say no to the man and have independent thought. Dylan encouraged and nourished those values, enabling youth at the time to feel as though their voices mattered, and, most importantly, that they were capable of making a lasting change in society. His lyrics were also a lot more straightforward than Berry's in terms of thematic intention. Berry hid messages under stories or encouraged teens to rebel in almost juvenile ways, such as not going to school. Dylan regarded the youth in a more respectful manner, almost, as if he were acknowledging that they weren't just kids listening to rebel music. In this way, Dylan managed to start a revolution of sorts through his music. His lyrics were complex and beautiful and clearly touched some souls. When he expressed his views on particular hot topics of the time, he wasn't trying to force his beliefs on people, but rather wanted to open their eyes to the possibility that they, too, could speak their mind and make a change. He showed his generation that they were not defined by the mistakes and hatred and bigotry of that of their parents. The times were changing.
Come gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
To this day, as I said, many consider Dylan to be a voice of a generation. But Dylan himself has said he doesn't feel this way and never has. All he wanted to do was make a change and express his views through his music. For the majority of the 60s, people agreed with him and thus praised him for this work. It wasn't until one day, 1965, when America's opinions on Dylan shifted. When at the Newport Folk Festival, Bob Dylan played three whole songs on the electric guitar. You might be thinking exactly what the crowd at Newport Folk Festival was thinking that fateful day. This is the least rebellious thing that Bob Dylan could have done. To many folkniks attending this festival, this was blasphemy. By plugging in, Dylan was selling out. But I think it was quite the opposite. You see, up until this point, many people in the folk community thought that music made with the electric guitar lacked the depth and intellectual merit of traditionally acoustic folk songs. The early 60s Bob Dylan sang about freedom from societal enslavement, while the Beatles were singing about girls. The folkniks were the 60s equivalent of 2010's hipsters, set in their ways with a hint of a superiority complex masked by what they considered to be taste. So, Bob Dylan, the king of folk, the anti-capitalist hero who marched hand in hand with his like-minded brethren, getting up on stage and playing the electric guitar? It was as if he spat in the face of each individual attendee. But as I said, many of these audience members completely missed the point. This was the most rebellious punk rock, yes, even before that was a thing that he could have done, because Dylan sacrificed this idolic status to again voice his opinion. That being, rock and roll can be meaningful too. By taking this stance, he changed the course of rock history forever. As a well-respected artist of the time, not only did fans look up to him, but also other artists. This shift in his musical journey signaled to others who looked up to him, like the Beatles and the Stones included, that the instruments used didn't matter, the tempo didn't matter, the intention is what did. So from then on, Bob Dylan continued to produce music that boasted his opinions and political stances. In 1976, he put out the song Hurricane, which outlined the true story of boxer Reuben Hurricane Carter. The song is quite lengthy and details the racial profiling that was involved in the boxer's conviction for a murder that he didn't commit. For the time, this type of stance against racism and a general call-out of the American legal system was extremely shocking, and since it was Bob Dylan telling the story, people paid attention. This again just goes to show that Bob Dylan never actually cared about the glory or the fame, but rather about the impact that his music made on others and the progression of society. For that reason, he is one of rock and roll's greatest rebels. Before I move on, I just wanted to take a second to provide some of my favorite Dylan tracks. I know a lot of people, especially people my age, don't really listen to Dylan, and like, I get it, his voice is definitely an acquired taste, but you have to admit that he's one of the greatest songwriters of all time. Even if you don't like that kind of country sound, if you don't like acoustic, if you don't like folk, I'm begging you, please, just take the time to listen to at least a couple of these songs. So, for the cult protest tunes, the album The Freewheelin' Bob Dylan is where you want to go. My suggestions from that one are Blowin' in the Wind, Girl from the North Country, Masters of War, A Hard Rain's A-Gonna Fall, and Don't Think Twice, It's All Right. All of those are classics and particularly highlight the type of songwriting I was talking about earlier on when discussing Dylan. From 1965's Highway 66, I would suggest like a Rolling Stone, Tombstone Blues, Ballad of a Thin Man, and Queen Jane Approximately. If you're gonna listen to one, make it that one. It is so fantastic. And this is a great example of Dylan's post-plugging in music. And then we have 1975's Blood on the Tracks, and the three core songs from there that I would suggest are Tangled Up in Blue, Idiot Wind, and Shelter from the Storm. Obviously, there's far more great material from Dylan's discography worth checking out, but those are just a few of my personal favorites and I think pretty good gateway songs. Now, at this point, I think it's clear that rock and roll music in all forms is synonymous with some sort of rebellious spirit. Rock and roll was born out of youth culture, and its greatest heroes are those that greatly inspired the youth of their generation. But sometimes, a music community or subgenre itself is so deeply rooted in anarchistic values that the entire group itself can be considered rebels in their own right. This is exactly the case with the punk movement of the 1970s. Now, this is a hefty one, so be prepared for a bit of a detour into the world of punk rock rebels. As the outrage over Bob Dylan's switch to electric guitar may have hinted at, music fans are often unwavering in their demand for artists to be authentic. When they didn't like the squeaky clean white pop they heard on the radio, they listened to Chuck Berry instead. When they wanted stripped down and raw protest music, they flocked to Bob Dylan. Then came a time in the early 70s when rock music became much more than a subgenre that parents didn't want their kids listening to. Bands sold out stadiums, rock songs got longer and more elaborate. Take Led Zeppelin, for example. They were playing for stadiums across the world, and many of their most notable songs, the first to come to mind is the 8-minute monster Stairway to Heaven, were far longer and more elaborate than the basic 3-minute track format that was normal during rock's infancy. So, as they often do, many rock fans took issue with this. They wanted to ground rock back to the simple guitar-based drum setup and shorter track times. The idea was to wipe out the existing rock and roll and start all over again. Hell, you didn't even have to know how to properly play your instrument or know any musical theory. All you needed was the right attitude and something to say. This was the beginnings of early punk. When it comes to labeling bands as punk bands specifically, things can get a little messy for two reasons. For one, the early bands who inspired the true punk rockers are in a bit of a genre limbo. As I said, many of these groups started with no intention but to redefine rock and roll. Thus, the very early developers of punk weren't themselves considered punk, but an alternative to the likes of Deep Purple or other stadium rockers of the time. Secondly, many bands who don't necessarily have the punk sound are considered to be, by many, punk because of their attitude. This again just goes to highlight the importance of punk in reclaiming rock's hold on its troublemaker or outsider status. Although a group may have had a completely different sound to that of true punk music, they themselves were considered punks because they sang about punk attitudes at punk clubs dressed like, well, punks. So, in a way, punk can be a bit of an umbrella term, but the definition that holds is a musical artist or fan who is part of the punk subculture. What is this subculture exactly? Well, first let's examine some of the groups who helped to build it. Let's start with the Velvet Underground.
Linger on, your pale blue eyes.
The underground subculture that fostered punk rock would likely not have come about, at least not in the same way as it did, without the help of artistic visionary Andy Warhol. Warhol was not only an artist and photographer, but was also trying his hand at talent management. He put together a band called the Velvet Underground, including the talents of Lou Reed, Sterling Morrison, John Cale, Moe Tucker, and Nico. The idea of the group was a big FU to the kind of music that was being produced at the time. Many people had grown bored of the happy-go-lucky, love-your-neighbor vibes of the hippies, and were looking for something new and fresh. With the Velvet Underground, they got just that.
'Cause everybody knows the thing she does to please. She's just a little tease.
The Velvet Underground stood out from the hippies in stark contrast. The hippies were bright and colorful. The underground were brooding and dark. The hippies sang of psychedelics and magic. The underground mumbled about art, death, and heroin. In terms of musicality, the underground were some of the first to take the stripped-down approach that would soon come to be associated with the punk scene. They had primal beats, soft instrumentals, and often brutally honest lyrics. It was so raw that it was refreshing. What Warhol and the underground did was push back against the pushback, rebelled against the rebels. They saw an opportunity to redefine what the music meant to people, and they took it, making Warhol and the group some of the most important rebels in rock and roll history.
And one fine morning she turns on a New York station. She doesn't believe what she hears at all. Ooh, she started dancing to that music. You know,
along with the underground, other bands in the early 70s were shaping the punk subgenre without even knowing it. The New York Dolls, a group that, you guessed it, are from New York City, sought to deconstruct glam rock rather than psychedelia. Taking influences from Bowie, they dressed up in drag to perform their music, which was a mishmash of harsh stones rock and girl group pop. Like many acts that would follow them, the Dolls thrived on shock value. They had their hair done up and wore lipstick and dresses, which for a while was enough to shock. But one day, they decided it wasn't enough. They needed to shake things up even more, piss some more people off. So, they thought to themselves, what is one thing that America hates the most right now? And the answer that they came up with was communism. Yes, you heard me correctly. I said communism. In an act of rebellion, or perhaps outright chaos, the group decided to hold a Red Party concert, where they dressed up in red and performed in front of a Soviet crest. None of the group was aligned with communist ideals in any way. They were just trying to ruffle some feathers. Unfortunately, they were a little too successful. The outrage resulting from the concert was a hit they were unable to recover from. Soon after the event, the group disbanded. Now, the third key group to break ground for the grunge movement was none other than Iggy Pop and the Stooges. James Newell Osterberg Jr., better known as Iggy Pop, is regarded by many as the godfather of punk. His outrageous performance style was extremely influential in that it was so shocking, half the audience didn't even know if they should cheer or run away. During performances with the Stooges, he would often contort his body in strange ways and sometimes even mutilate himself in front of the crowd. People of the time had likely heard of Jimi Hendrix setting his guitar on fire, but no one had ever gone as far as Iggy did. In this way, he was a pioneer not only of the punk rock scene itself, but the overall punk rock, I don't care what you think attitude.
Give me a danger, little stranger, and I'll give you a piece. Give me a danger, little stranger.
Much like the Velvet Underground, Iggy and the Stooges also set themselves apart from the rock and roll being made at the time by their deconstructed sound and taboo subject matter. I mean, at the time, Iggy saying he wanted to be someone's dog was so degrading and dirty and, well, disobedient. No one had really done this before. And long before Ozzy bit the head off of a bat on stage, Iggy Pop was breaking all the rules for stage presence and opening doorways for strange and unruly acts to follow him. Those are the core three acts that helped to establish the groundwork for what would become known as punk rock, the most disruptive, outrageous, and creative version of rock and roll yet. Now, that isn't to say that there weren't other acts who also helped to build the scene in New York. As I mentioned in the last episode, Patti Smith was an extremely influential figure at the time. Being a poet first and foremost, Smith bent the rules of what a rock performance could include, initially performing at the same clubs as early punk rock acts, simply speaking with a guitar in the back. From there, she progressed to write actual songs, the content of which was extremely shocking and sometimes controversial. You can imagine that conservatives at the time weren't very happy when they heard the opening line of her song Gloria, as she proclaimed that Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not hers.
Jesus died for somebody's sins, but not mine. Milner.
After the rise of these four acts, it seemed as though everyone who attended one of their shows started a band. Around 1975, bands started popping up all around New York City with the same sort of deconstructed and harsh sound. They were tired of being joyful, tired of being political, tired of the hippies, tired of the war in Vietnam. Basically, they were just tired, and they were ready to express this in their music. The punk culture that grew in New York went back to the bare bones of youthful rebellion, and that it was completely self-made. There was no cushy record deals with major labels in the beginning, providing people with all the funds and studio time that they needed. Groups simply got together, made a demo, and handed out posters to promote their own bands. These groups would often play at one of two clubs in New York City that were the subculture breeding ground. These clubs included CBGB, which ironically stood for Country Bluegrass Blues, and Max's. The only rule to play at CBGB's was simple. You had to write your own music. Many groups, despite a ghastly lack of talent in songwriting and instrument playing, decided to take on this challenge. One of the most notorious of these groups was a leather-clad group that called themselves the Ramones. If you ask any attendee who saw the Ramones at their first nights at CBGB, they will probably tell you that they were awful, and that they likely went back the next night too. The Ramones were influential in that they clearly didn't care about the way that they actually played or sounded. They simply wanted to perform, and to do it in a fast and thrashing manner. One group member said that they were trying to do the stripped-down approach of many bands at the time, and the majority of their songs were supposed to be 3 minutes in length. The problem was, they played so fast, they usually cut the playtime in half.
Yeah.
What is essential to grasp about the Ramones is that they were unwavering in their discontent for perfection and complying with the rules. They made their own rules, and in that way, they brought something completely new to the table, no matter how bad they might have initially sounded. Now, around the time of the Ramones and bands like them, the punk underground began picking up steam and getting some attention from the media. This is when the name punk actually began circulating, as it was used to describe the members of this subculture in print media around the city. It was assumed that these individuals were all hooligans of sorts. It didn't matter what kind of music they played. If they were associated with the attitude that was synonymous with the underground scene, they were considered punks. The fact that many groups gladly took up this name is a testament to the unwavering need to piss off the public. It was as if being labeled a punk made you automatically dangerous or untrustworthy. Debbie Harry, the frontwoman of punk band Blondie, has even mentioned that while at a radio station, people looked at her with fear as if she was going to pull a knife on them. Now, I'm not saying that this type of profiling is something to be celebrated, but it does show that the punk scene and the individuality that it stood for was getting under the skin of the public. And isn't that what the whole rock and roll attitude is all about? Along with the Ramones and Blondie, there came Television, The Talking Heads, Sonic Youth, Suicide, and many more. The New York punk scene was extremely important in breaking barriers in rock and roll that many were too afraid to. New York punks weren't afraid to rediscover what rock and roll meant to them individually and make it their own, much to the dismay of close-minded individuals. But if you think punk in America shook up the culture, just wait until we talk about England. That punk was making its rise in America, the social political climate in the UK was crumbling. Youth were extremely discontent and society was falling apart. Gaining inspiration from the FU attitude of American punks, the Brits decided it was time to do something for themselves. Punk culture and fashion became all the rage from 1974 onward, thanks to Vivienne Westwood and Malcolm McLaurin. The two owned a shop on King's Road in London called Sex, where they sold all kinds of outlandish garments. Soon, people were walking along the streets of England with clothes safety pinned together and pants with bondage on them. In England, the punk look was almost as important as the music itself. The clothing was an outward representation of discontent with the state of British society. It was as if the youth were saying, yes, we're anarchists, and what about it? One of the most outwardly rebellious groups in rock history were the kings of the British punk movement, the Sex Pistols. Managed by sex shop owner Malcolm McLaurin, the group certainly looked the part, and when they got up on stage with their barely tuned instruments, they played the part too. In a manner similar to the Ramones, the Sex Pistols were pretty bad musicians, but again, in punk that doesn't really matter. In fact, some might even consider it an asset. It was part of the anarchistic image that they weren't polished. They were harsh and rugged and couldn't care less. At a show, someone yelled at the stage, "You can't play," to which the band replied, "So what?" Considering they were only together for in and around 2 years, the upset in Britain the group managed to cause is extremely impressive. Their first and only album, called Never Mind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols, was chock full of anti-royal sentiment. The single, God Save the Queen, criticized conformity in Britain and the public's defense of the crown. Promotional imagery for the record contained pictures of Queen Elizabeth with her eyes scratched out. As one can imagine, this caused quite the upset in the public. If that wasn't enough, their appearance on the Bill Grundy show certainly sealed the deal. The group, encouraged by Grundy, I might add, swore on national television, making themselves the poster boys of filth to the civilized public and the heroes of the youth culture. In this way, they're likely some of the most rebellious figures in rock history and are often one of the first names to come up whenever punk is discussed.
God save the Queen! The fascist regime! They made you a moron! Potential hate bomb!
Well, the Pistols' music was revolutionary in its simple three-chord format with an emphasis on lyrics. Their lyrics were often just saying what they were upset about. Another group from England took this one step further. The Clash sang about what they thought was wrong with England, but also what they intended to do about it.
Woo! Darling, you got to let me know. Should I stay or should I go?
Angry, loud, and questioning, the Clash were building momentum in the 70s with various releases, but they really came into their own with their 1979 release, London Calling. Much like the other artists I've mentioned thus far, the Clash connected much with youth culture due to their outwardly political lyrics and dismay for the state of the country. In fact, they connected with audiences so much that they became known in the media and among fans alike as the only band that matters. Now that's quite the title. If you haven't already listened to the album London Calling, please do. For me, there's absolutely no skips, and there's a bit of something for everyone. And honestly, I think that's what makes them all the more punk rock. They sang about what they cared about, they deconstructed rock to what they wanted it to be, but they also weren't afraid to mix genres, including punk, reggae, and even rockabilly. The Clash may not have been as outwardly crass as the Sex Pistols, but they were perhaps even more rebellious, just in a more calculated and meaningful way.
When they kick at your front door, how you gonna come?
Political protest songs, we have to give mention to another group that came about in the 1990s. Rage Against the Machine, a group from LA, was an immediate success with their first release in 1992. But to the band, the music was simply a means to an end. Like Dylan and The Clash, Rage Against the Machine saw their music as an opportunity to spread their political views. All four members were far leftists who wanted to use their lyrics to slander corporate America, cultural imperialism, and government oppression. An example of this is one of their most well-known songs, Killing in the Name of, which outwardly discusses the KKK and white supremacy ties to the police force in America. Have a listen. When the band was asked to perform on Saturday Night Live in 1996, they had no intention of changing their set or censoring their lyrics to appease SNL's typical viewership. However, it just so happened that the guest host that same week was to be Republican Steve Forbes. In typical Rage Against the Machine fashion, the group decided to hang inverted American flags behind them during the performance. According to the group, the flags were a symbol of, and quote, "Our contention that American democracy is inverted when what passes for democracy is an electoral choice between two representatives of the privileged class. America's freedom of expression is inverted when you're free to say anything you want to say until it upsets a corporate sponsor. Finally, this was our way of expressing our opinion of the show's host, Steve Forbes." During the performance, SNL staffers removed the flags, and the group was escorted out of the building immediately after their performance. I think this group's connection to rebellion needs no further explanation. In In terms of hip-hop and rap, which are a offshoot of rock and roll in a way, we cannot go without mentioning the most influential group to make waves in politics and encourage more black-centered discourse in popular music. That group was Public Enemy.
Listen if you're missing, y'all. Swing it while I'm singing. Hey! Giving what you're getting. Knowing what I'm knowing. While the black band's sweating. In the rhythm I'm rolling. Gotta give us what we want. Gotta give us what we need.
Hey!
Our freedom of speech is freedom of death. We got to fight the powers that be. Fight the power. Fight the power.
Before Public Enemy, their debut being in 1986, politically motivated hip-hop was scarce. Members Chuck D and Flavor Flav thought it was time to mesh the hard-hitting style of Run-DMC with politics that addressed black youth. Had Public Enemy not taken this stance, we likely would not have gotten the same Afrocentric-themed music that we did from Kool Moe Dee, Gangstar, X-Clan, and Queen Latifah.
Dirty got nothing to do with rap. Check the facts, expose those cats. Who pose as heroes, take advantage of blacks. Your government's gangsters, so cut the crap. A war going on, so where y'all at?
Alright, now, if you thought we were going to make it through an episode without me mentioning Nirvana, you were wrong. The last rock and roll rebels we are discussing this week are the members of Nirvana, and more specifically, the band's frontman, Kurt Cobain.
She has me like a Pisces well.
Evident throughout the episode that those rock stars which connect the most with some sort of subjugated group are often viewed as the most rebellious. Kurt Cobain is probably one of the most beloved artists because of his relatability and kind soul. I touched upon this in my Kurt episode a bit, but I want to go a bit more in depth here in pointing out that what made Kurt so great was that he wasn't afraid to point out the clear misogyny in the music industry. In my opinion, one of the most rebellious things that an individual can do is to take a stance against the community of which they are a part of. Yes, Kurt was a grunge rocker and held close many grunge values about authenticity and not selling out, like many of the New York punks of the 1970s, but what made him different was that his individuality expanded beyond his solidarity with this musical community. In a letter for the group's 1992 compilation album Incesticide, which I've talked about in previous episodes, Kurt wrote the following. If any of you in any way hate homosexuals, people of color, or women, please do this one favor for us. Leave us the F alone. Don't come to our shows and don't buy our records. Similarly, in the CDs for 1993's In Utero was a note reading the following. If you're a sexist, racist, homophobe, or basically an a-hole, don't buy this CD. I don't care if you like me. I hate you. Cobain and Nirvana also performed alongside L7 and several other grunge bands for their Rock for Choice concerts, a series of shows aimed to raise money for women's right to choose and to encourage similar rallies across America. He was even arrested once for spray painting "God is Gay" on cars in Washington State. In the same way that the Clash were trying to change what the Sex Pistols were whining about, Kurt wanted to change what the punk counterculture, which developed eventually into grunge, had too been whining about for years. He once said the following. I'm disgusted by my own and my generation's apathy. I'm disgusted at what we allow to go on, by how spineless, lethargic, and guilty we are of not standing up against racism, sexism, and all those other isms that the counterculture has been whining about for years, while they sit and enforce those same values every night on their televisions and in the magazines. Kurt not only recognized the importance of artistic expression and reaching like-minded audiences, but he also recognized the need for true action, which makes him one of the most respectable rebels on this list. That's my my list of notable rock and roll rebels throughout the decades. I've obviously missed some, as most rockers can be considered rebels to some capacity, but if I missed a blindingly obvious one and you can't wait to shove it in my face, send me a DM over on Instagram. It's Megan Folsom, MeganFulsom. That being said, thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of The Downbeat, and hopefully I'll see you next time. Bye.